Gospel News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I think I'm Jim Russ.
And we've been doing a lot of pre-production work for this show.
Something like that.
Oh, by the way, we're also going to feature today on Tech Talk. It's going to be the guy who was co-founder of Box.com.
Uh-huh.
It's a cloud storage facility, and it's another guy who had to drop out of college to get his... Actually, he did, but he's elevated it. He didn't drop out of college. He took a leave from college. It was more acceptable to his parents.
Yes.
And, of course, we had a huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yes. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, because you are one of the best IT people, oh, you know, she just knows how to get her.
How did that make it to the top of the mailbag?
She knows how to get her letters. Because you're one of the best IT people I know, I would like to learn if you know of a device for your car that gives you a heads up when you're approaching a speed camera. Whoops.
Huh.
Either a mobile or a fixed unit one. I live in Montgomery County. And these things are being deployed like gangbusters. These devices are multiplying every day. And they are a gigantic money machine for Maryland.
Yes, they are.
And I just don't want to contribute to it. Most appreciated, Margaret.
Okay.
Well, let me talk. There are a number of ways you can handle this, some legal and some illegal.
Good.
I'll point that out. There are GPS sensors that use a database of known speed cameras. And you simply download the speed camera locations to your database, and as your GPS sensor shows that you're getting close to a speed camera, it will give you an alarm. Now, that's only as good as the database, which means it's probably not going to work for these mobile speed cams that they move around.
That was my point, exactly.
It won't handle the mobile speed cams, but the fixed speed cams, it's going to pick up. And the subscription for the data runs anywhere from $35 to $100, but I did find one that got pretty good reviews, the GPS Angel V4E Red Light and Speed Camera Detector, and it includes a lifetime camera database subscription, and that sells for $60. And the reviews were saying that, you know, they actually got their $60 back just fairly quickly because they didn't get as many tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second type, it actively detects the speed camera because they detect your speed using the Doppler shift. They shine radiation at you, either microwave radiation or optical radiation, like from a laser, and the frequency is slightly shifted, and the faster you're going, the bigger the frequency shift, and so they can calculate your speed. So you can actually...
Can they calculate your fine?
Yeah, they do that very quickly.
Mm.
Yeah. And so you can actually get basically a radar detector or a laser detector, and it will warn you when that's coming up. Now, that would work for the mobile units because it's detecting it. Now, the downside is that kind of radar detector is illegal in some states. I know that it's illegal in Virginia.
They're all, and I believe in D.C. too.
So I did know one guy who used to work with me many years ago, and he would put it on his dashboard, and he'd throw this sock hat over it because the radiation goes right through the sock.
Sure.
So then he just had this little you know like a ski cap sitting on his dashboard. That's how he manages it. But that's illegal, and if they catch you, that there's a fine for that.
And there's points too in some states for that.
Now the third option is to put a reflective coating on your license plate. So whenever there's a flash, it's sort of like, you know, it gives a lot of back reflection,
mm-hmm.
and the coating will not allow off-axis viewing. And you can buy a spray can of photo blocker for $29.
Whoa!
Is that
legal?
I don't know. I think that's getting ahead of the legality. It's as long as you can still read the numbers when you're following the car. There's no problem because this is a coating over the numbers. I would suspect that police officers would frown on this. Now, Margaret, this is the fourth option, and this is the option that I fully recommend. Okay, get out paper and pencil.
Okay,
listen
to
me.
This is totally legal, too.
Yeah. Do not speed.
Whoa. Really?
Yeah. You know,
I never would have thought.
Margaret, that works every single time.
It does. Well, you know, option number one, I think, would lull you into a sense of false security, because you would know there's so many of these mobile units out there that, you know.
They're quite. And see, now, some of them, like if you've got a Garmin or a TomTom, you can actually subscribe to that service where they'll download that data right to your TomTom or navigation system automatically. And that works fairly well. And then you just pay for the subscription for it. But this speed camera, it actually has a GPS built into the thing, that $60 one from Angel. That the Angel GPS system.
Hmm.
We got an email from. I only gave that because actually I don't like these speed cameras. I think these are turned into be money makers. I don't think they necessarily enhance safety.
I would agree with you. And the red light cameras. Some places have made a case for that they actually cause accidents because people know that it's there. The light turns yellow. They jam on the brakes and they get rear-ended.
That's right.
So it actually causes more accidents than it.
That's right. And there have been some jurisdictions that have reduced the time of the yellow light in order to trigger more tickets.
And that's dangerous.
That's dangerous, too. So, but still, Margaret, despite those feelings, I still recommend that you don't speed.
That's right.
Now, we got an email from a Maryland listener. Dear Dr. Schertz, I just finished gathering and documenting the business intelligence reporting and analytics requirement for a complex software tool. We will then create a set of business intelligence reporting and analytics reports. Now, I'm going to have to provide training for the users, but I don't really know much about this database reporting. How long do you think it would take me to master the Microsoft SQL Server Reporting Services, so-called SSRS, and be able to lead the training? What would be the best method to master this? Most appreciated, a Maryland listener. Well, the SSRS, as you noted, is the Microsoft SQL Reporting Services. That's a way to create reports. And it creates web-enabled reports, so you can create these reports. People can log onto the web, and they can look at them once you've created them. And you can publish the results of those reports in various formats right from the SSRS. Now, it's an excellent tool for extracting data from a Microsoft SQL database. In fact, we use this enterprise server for our reporting at Stratford University quite a bit. Now, this is actually an opportunity for you, Margaret, because people that know how to do reports any sort of these SQL reports with SQL enterprise services are really in demand. So the way I learned things, first of all, I would get a book on the enterprise reporting services. And then I would basically start creating just a report. So you understand what I just take any kind of report and just start working on it. Now you are going to have to understand something about database structure, because when you're extracting data, the data is combined in tables. So you might want to combine the results from multiple tables, which means you have to link the tables using an index like employee number.
Mm-hmm.
So you might use the index field for the employee number, and then you could link address and the city and their position all at one item. So you have to know something about database architecture, and so I would recommend that you actually start trying to figure out how relational databases work, because if you understand that, then you know how to combine two tables. That's called a join. So you would understand that. And then just start working. The other thing you'd have to know is what are the names of the fields for the database you're using, and that's in a data dictionary. So you need to know a little bit about the structure of the data. You need to know the data dictionary, and then just start creating reports and playing around with it. Now, if other people have created reports that are going to be used as this BI application, I would take, once you've played around and made your own report, I'd go in and look at these reports, and you can save it as a temporary file, and you can modify it and play around with an existing report to see what you can do. That's probably the best way to learn it, and I can tell you, if you get good at using Microsoft enterprise reporting services, you're going to be employable for a good long while to come. And you can also reporting services for Oracle, any of the SQL databases. It's all kind of a common set of knowledge. If you learn one, you'll be able to apply it to all the databases. Great question. And it's very bright of you to actually try to learn something new so that you become more important to your company. We have an email from Andrew. Recently, I tried to use RoboForm for an account at a large financial system, but I couldn't get it to work. In response to my inquiry, this institution said that they do not permit login using credentials that are stored on software because the security of the password could become jeopardized if my computer were hacked, invaded, etc. Is this true? Am I safer not to use RoboForm? Thank you, Andrew. Well, technically, they are correct. Well, first of all, let's explain what RoboForm
is.
Yeah. RoboForm is a vault where you store your passwords. And so what you do is that in this RoboForm, you store your passwords there, and it will automatically transfer the password from RoboForm database right into the field that you are filling out when you're logging on, when you do a log on. So you don't have to type the passwords. You could have some really complicated passwords, like 20 characters long, mm-hmm. that you'd never remember. And RoboForm just plops it right into the password field and automatically you log in. Which is very convenient. Now, it is technically true that if your computer were corrupted or were hacked and somebody could log into your RoboForm database, they could get all those passwords. But that is relatively unlikely. And so I think many people who don't use these password storage techniques, what they end up doing, they end up using the same password on every single website. And they typically have a short password because they want to remember it, like something like, I love my husband or Frank is great. Something that you can probably guess, you know.
Okay.
I mean, you know, people use all kinds of really simple passwords, or the name of their children or the name of their dog or password written backwards. I mean, they think they're always clever. And so what you need to do if you have a password protection program, RoboForm is a very, very popular one, and LastPass is another one. Those are two that are very popular. You want to get a single password that is very hard to crack, that people couldn't guess, and do not store the password on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it in only one place, and one place only, in your head. Or else you could put it on a piece of paper and file it someplace far away from the computer. Now, the nice thing is if you've got these devices that store the passwords, you then don't worry about getting a complicated password and having a different password for every website. And so you probably will have better security practices overall. So I disagree with the bank. I think if they don't accept this automatic login, they're forcing their users to go back to their bad practices of passwords that they can remember. And probably the same password as in other websites. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. While they were technically correct, I think that they were misdirected in having that particular idea. So I'd still recommend RoboForm or LastPass, but then you'll just have to look up the password and type it in the case of that
right.
Bank. We got an email from Ron in Springfield. Dear Tech Talk, I have a home network with three computers, two desktops connected via Ethernet, and a laptop connected via wireless to a Linksys router. Wireless router. The wireless signal is encrypted, and I gave my next-door neighbor my network key so they can connect to my network just to check their email and do banking, etc. They're not on my home network, but can they see what I'm actually surfing? What can they do if they have access to my network? Thanks, Ron. Well, Ron, if you give someone access to your wireless access point, you've actually given them access to your own home network. They can see all the computers on the network. So I hope that you trust them.
Yeah.
They can see them. So one thing I would do is I would disable any file sharing. You know, you can share files between the same computers on the same network, because if you're sharing files on the network, you're also sharing them with them. They could probably sniff your network. There are programs that allow you to look at all the packets that are in the air, and they could basically look at the individual packets that you're doing, and they could reconstruct what you're doing on the web, but that requires that have to have some technical knowledge. Now, probably they could if your neighbor's computers are infected with malware, they frequently propagate to all the other machines on the network. That's probably your biggest danger. They get infected with malware, and then you get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the biggest danger. Now, they could also, if they do more than email, if they, for instance, use peer-to-peer file sharing, they could sap up all your bandwidth. So these are four areas that you may want to have concern with, but I would certainly worry that that malware would be the biggest issue. Now, so to protect yourself, you want to turn on the firewall on each of your machines in the network. See, the router is actually also a firewall to the Internet, but now you've got an outsider in your network. So now you've got to have a firewall on each of your computers, which means you'll have cascading firewalls. It'll be a little bit slower, but I would advise you to do that. Now, you may also want to put a router, a wireless router between you and your neighbor. So what you could do is you could get another wireless router, which also has a firewall in it. You could plug it into the Ethernet port of your main wireless router, and then you connect to the secondary router so that you've got the secondary router between you and the neighbor. So they can't see you. They're just on a network all by themselves as this other router. That's probably the safest way to do that. And most people have an old router laying around the house because, you know, every time you change cable modems, you get a new router. That's what I would probably do. Now, there are some legal issues that I want to point out to you. Chances are sharing your wireless network with your neighbor violates the terms of service with your ISP. I'm thinking that they would rather Verizon or Cox Cable would rather have your neighbor pay them a subscription fee, and I think buried in the terms of service, you're not allowed to share. Mm-hmm. So that could be a problem. Also, if they download music illegally, the police are going to think that it is your IP address. Or if they go to, say, sites that are illegal, like child porn sites,
right.
there was somebody's house was actually police went in the middle of the night. They broke in the doors because they thought this house had a lot of computers with child porn on it. And mm-hmm. it turned out that there was none of that in that house. Somebody had just hacked. Somebody was just used. They didn't even secure their wireless network.
Right.
Somebody in the neighborhood had been using their wireless network to access these websites. But it created probably 30 minutes of terror when they were interrupted in the middle of the night. So all of these factors considered, just make certain you trust your neighbor before you
this
do that.
It's just a really bad idea.
It is a bad idea. Now, you could,
I get it, but you just never know.
It's hard to tell your neighbor, hey, you know, I really don't trust you. So, I mean, you can't do that. So what I would do, I would just put a secondary router up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could also, if you're not using peer-to-peer file sharing, you could actually disallow it on the main router so he couldn't do that. You can also set priorities up where your computers always have a higher priority on the network than his computer. So if he starts, like, soaking up all the bandwidth, you basically throttle him down because your computers are king on the network. You can go into the router, the main router, and you can adjust those priorities. That was a great question,
yeah.
And you got a lot to think about there, John. Ron, got a lot there to
yes.
think about, Ron. We've got an email from John in Fairfax. I have an HP OfficeJet 6500 wireless printer. Sometimes it will not connect to my laptop via Wi-Fi. I've gone to HP's website. I've downloaded everything. But I still can't print. The printer's 4 or 5 years old. Do you have any advice? Thanks, John. Well, first of all, I would clear the print queue. A lot of times, I have to say, I have the same problem in my household because there's somebody that uses my computer or uses their computer, and they can never print anything.
Somebody.
Somebody. I don't want to state any names.
Anybody's names. No.
And always, and they, Rick, my printer does I print, and then I have to go through this whole process to get it printing and get it connected. So first thing, and in their case, in her case, I should say.
Now we know who it is.
Oh, okay. Okay. In their place. What you want to do, you want to print clear your print queue because what I've discovered, when somebody's printer doesn't work, they might have 20 jobs backlogged, and the first job's not printing, it just jammed, so everything just stops.
Right.
So then what you do, you click on that little printer symbol in the lower right-hand corner, and it brings up a list of jobs, and then you just basically clear the print queue. That's what I do first, and that works. Sometimes the jobs go, when they go through the wireless router, there's kind of an intermediate buffering that's done by the wireless router, so sometimes they're sort of just caught in midstream. So if that actually doesn't work, then what I do, I always reboot. I reboot the laptop. Mm-hmm. I reboot the wireless router, and I reboot the printer. I sort of bring everything back to standard. Now, that almost always works.
Yeah.
Now, if you still can't print to the printer, it must mean that the print driver is corrupted. So then what I do, I uninstall the print driver, and then I reinstall the printer. And then after that, I reboot the computer, and then, actually, uninstall the printer, I reboot the computer, and then I reinstall the printer.
Gotcha.
And all of those things are working out. Now, if that doesn't actually work, then there may be something wrong with your printer, or you could check whether another computer could print to it. If you have somebody else bring over their laptop and you test that, there might be something wrong with the laptop or the wireless connection. But that process that I just gave you should probably work in most instances.
It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio. Heard in Washington, D.C. on 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk coming right up, right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to be talking about Aaron Levy. Aaron Levy is the CEO and co-founder of Box.com, which helps people access their information from any location using the cloud. Aaron Levy was born in 1987 in Seattle, Washington. He was raised in Seattle, and where he attended high school. Then he spent most of his time as a youngster just sitting around playing with his computers. His dad had a lot of computers. His dad was in technology, and so it was just natural for him to want to play around with these computers. He did enroll in the University of Southern California, USC. Mom and Dad were very happy. Yeah. He enrolled in the Marshall School of Business. You'd think it would be a technical degree, but he went to the Marshall School of Business at USC. While in college, he had two internships that actually influenced his thinking quite dramatically. These were with the film industry. He had an internship with Miramax for 3 months, and then he had an internship with Paramount Pictures for 4 months. He was a file clerk. And he used to take these files, these big legal contracts, he'd go to this huge room with all these file cabinets, and he would file these contracts away. He did that for 7 months, and he said, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so then he said, you know, I think we need to have a way to share data and share files, over the Internet. So in school, he was taking a marketing class, and so he did a SWOT analysis for, digital file sharing. And when he did this analysis, he discovered that there were basically very few meaningful such services on the market. This was back in 2004. See, now we've got Microsoft SkyDrive and Google G Drive. So the big guys have gotten to this cloud storage. But back in 2004, it was like virgin territory. So he had a real opportunity here. So in 2005, he decided to build a company that would provide service technology to the market. In other words, cloud storage and cloud computing to the market. And he launched Box.com or Box.net. He got all the domain names. He launched it from his dorm room with the help of his friend Dylan Smith, who was actually attending Duke University at the time. And he made Dylan the CFO, and he was the CEO. Now, they focused on incorporating the best traditional content management and social business software using the cloud and cloud storage. They incorporated their business April of 2005 in Mercer Island, Washington. He then went out and started sending out cold emails to all these VCs and angel investors, and he sent one cold, just a cold email. He sent it to Mark Cuban, the Texas Air billionaire.
Right.
The Texas billionaire. And Mark said, hey, this was a pretty good idea. And he gave them an initial funding as an angel investor. So Aaron called his mom and said, Mom, I'm going to take a leave of absence from school. I'm not dropping out, Mom.
Nope.
I'm taking a leave of absence, and I'm going to finish my degree, but I've got to do this right now. His mom was a little worried. She's not certain whether he's ever going to get back to school. Now, it turned out that Dylan tried to do the same thing with his parents. No go. Mm-hmm. He ended up graduating from Duke.
Gee, you know, worse things could happen.
Yeah, he ended up graduating from Duke, and he was majoring in economics. That's why he's the CFO. In the summer of 2006, the company moved to Palo Alto, California. That's, of course, up there by Silicon Valley. And they wanted to be part of the Silicon Valley ecosystem, where everybody was willing to take chances to innovate. The excitement of Silicon Valley they thought was very important to the culture of their company. Now, Box is an SaaS, service, software as a service. In other words, you just pay for what you use. You don't buy the software, you just use the service. Mm-hmm. So it's all using cloud storage, and they're trying to combine the features of traditional content management with the usability of typical collaborative online software. So you can share your files, you can edit your files, you can share the edits, all of that kind of thing. Now, Box wants to reinvent the way businesses share and manage access to all their content using cloud content management services. Now, he got other investors. Turns out that Aaron is a darn good salesman. He got other companies to invest. He got VC firms like Andreessen Horowitz, Draper Fisher, Jervston, Emergent Capital Partners, Meritech Capital Partners, Scale Venture Partners, and U.S. Venture Partners. His last round of financing came from a couple of big guys, Salesforce and SAP. He raised a total of $162 million dollars since the launch. Now, in order to get people to use the service, he used the freemium model, as they say. He gave away 1 gigabyte of free space. If you want to share your files, you could just get up an account, not pay anything, upload up to 1 gig of free, and then you start sharing it. And his idea was he'd get a bunch of employees at companies using it to share files, and they'd say, hey, we really like this thing. And then the employees would say, why don't we get a corporate account so we can all share? So he was sort of going in the back door using the freemium account, and that was a very successful model. Now, Box does provide full professional services in the business enterprise space. So once these guys that were wanted to go above 1 gig or wanted to talk to more people, and they got the enterprise to buy into it, then he would get all the seats, everybody in the business, and it was very, very successful. Box is now valued at $600 million and has 500 employees. So, Mom, I don't know if Aaron's ever going to get back and finish his degree.
No.
I've listened to Aaron. I've listened to quite a few of his videos. He's given a lot of talks. Aaron does not give me the impression he's going to go back to school. I think he's also, by the way, a very rich bachelor.
Okay.
So he's got a girlfriend, but they're not married. So there's hope for some of the women out there in Silicon Valley. Box has 82% of the Fortune 500 companies. That's pretty impressive.
That is pretty impressive.
It has over 100,000 companies as clients, and it has more than 7 million users. Now, the biggest threat is the other cloud storage. You know, Google came up with G Drive. Microsoft's came out with SkyDrive. So the question is, how is Box going to compete with these big guys?
Mm-hmm.
I saw him. He was interviewed by a number of the tech guys, and he said this is not going to be a problem because he is so focused on enterprise tools that he thinks the level of service that he's going to provide is going to beat the big guys. He's small, nimble, and he can deal with the customer in a much better way. So he doesn't think there's going to be a problem with this at all. He is inspired by Steve Jobs, and this influences the way he does everything. The first thing is, he's always searching for the simplest solution. So if you go to box.com, it's really easy to sign up. you want to do a one-click sign-up, something very simple. That's Amazon. Say, that's why Amazon was so successful. One click and you can buy. Mm-hmm. So Amazon made buying online very simple. Google made search online very simple. So simple wins. And so he had a very simple look, and that's, of course, a Steve Jobs idea. You make all your devices simple so anybody can use them.
Yep.
The second thing is search for a simplest solution. He also wanted to prepare users for the post PC world. So he wanted something that would allow users to bring the technology to the enterprise. See, this is what Steve Jobs did. He never really penetrated industry too fast for a long while, until we got this trend of bring your own device to work. Mm-hmm. So people started bringing their own iPhone to work. And then there was such a demand for iPhones, the enterprise finally supported the iPhone as an enterprise service. And so that's the strategy here. And it turns out that the biggest driver for this distributed storage has been caused by these mobile devices. Like, you've got an iPad here. You do some work on the iPad. You save it on the iPad. You want it to automatically go to your own computer. And so cloud storage for the iPad and all these tablets became a very important deal. And people are using the freemium model to get connected with their iPad, and then they convince the enterprise to go after. So it's the same strategy that Steve Jobs used. He was featured in the 30 most influential under 30 CEOs and in Inc. magazine's top 30 entrepreneurs under 30, as well as in Fast Company. The web address is www.box.com, and if he ever goes back to school and finishes, I'll make certain of a special Tech Talk update on that.
I have a funny feeling that's probably not going to happen, though. You are listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Learn everything you wanted to know about this show by going to our website, techtalkonline.com, and find out more about our sponsors by going to stratford.edu. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Epic Man. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here. And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for substandard academic affairs. When I take over the pop quiz, let's just say it gets a whole lot easier for you, the listening audience. Today we're talking about Aaron Levy, the CEO and co-founder of Box.com. While he was in college, he had two internships. If you can tell us just one of the places where he interned, you will win free tickets, dining for two, at the Escafé at Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church, or at Cafe Karim on the campus in Woodbridge. If you're calling from west of Seattle, Washington, is 877-936-9333. From east of Mercer Island, Washington, it is 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wildcard line is 877-936-9333. Adjunct Professor for Prize Distribution, Andrew Mitchell, standing by to answer the phones. This is the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio. Up next is a segment Dr. Schertz and I did on the very first show we did together almost exactly 6 years ago. Back then, our shows aired on Sunday mornings. This was the Sunday that the clocks went ahead. Daylight saving time had just gone into effect. So don't get confused. Clocks go ahead tomorrow. We're going to talk about daylight saving time now on Tech Talk Radio.
I have radio-controlled clocks, so my clocks reset themselves automatically at night. When I woke up, they had the right time on them.
Radio-controlled or atomic clocks?
Well, these were radio-controlled based on the atomic time standard.
But we call them atomic clocks. I keep thinking there's something radioactive inside these things.
Well, we're going to get into that, explain exactly how they work, and they're actually these clocks only cost me $50.
Really?
They're actually very cheap.
Where'd you get them?
I got them on the internet. Actually, I just ordered them from Amazon. And so that's always what I, you know, when I buy stuff, I go on to, I always get the cheapest price on the internet. I go to this program called Frugal, which is a part of the Google network, and I just put in what I want to buy, and it searches the internet for the cheapest price of that product, and it sorts it by price. And then I just go to a vendor that has a good rating, that has the cheapest price. It takes me about 10 minutes to get the cheapest price on anything.
So every clock in the Schertz house is an atomic clock?
No, not every.
So you had to reset a few clocks.
No, this is what I've got. I've got also cuckoo clocks. Beside every cuckoo clock, I have an atomic clock, so I can always adjust my pendulum.
So do you have any atomic cuckoos?
No, not that.
Well, so how do these atomic clocks work?
Well, what they have in them, they actually receive a radio signal from Fort Collins, Colorado. That is the that's where the time standards are set up for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. And out in that area, they have a 60 kilohertz broadcast station that sends out signals which have the time standard on it. It sends out, since it's 60 kilohertz is a very low frequency, that's the low frequency band, it sends out the signal at 1 bit per second. It takes 1 minute to send out the entire time signature. And so these clocks have a radio built into them tuned to 60 kilohertz. And when they receive the time standard from Fort Collins, Colorado, they simply reset themselves.
So we go to Frugal, we buy our atomic clock. It arrives at the house sometime during the day. Hang it on the wall. The time's wrong. You can't reset it,
right? There are no knobs on the back. You can't reset it. Now, unfortunately, in the Washington, D.C. area, we're quite a distance from Fort Collins. In order to get the signal here, it has to bounce off the ionosphere, which only happens at night. So when I got my first atomic clock, I actually was really disappointed.
So you didn't know this?
I didn't know that at all. Mm-hmm. And so I turned it on in the day, and the darn thing didn't work. And they said, well, new time standards transmitted every few minutes. And I thought, so I kept waiting and checking back, taking out the battery, putting it back in, resetting it. I mean, I spent hours, and I was thinking my atomic clock was broken.
If it's an atomic clock, what do you need a battery for, right?
Then I went to bed. And in the morning, I woke up and it reset.
Amazing.
And then I discovered, and actually it reset as soon as the sun went down.
Now, how far away from Fort Collins would you have to be for it to update right then and there? How far does that signal travel during the daytime?
I think when you get out in the Midwest, it would be right at the, immediately. It doesn't require a bounce off the ionosphere. Now, also in this area, if you're in a bunker here that can't get any signals in, you might have a problem having it reset. But just in a regular house, it is not a problem at all.
This is the same principle as listening to AM radio at night, to far off AM stations.
That's right. And you see, this is 60 kilohertz. The lowest frequency on the AM dial is 530 kilohertz. So this is about one-tenth the frequency of the lowest AM band, the low frequency band, and it's the same principle.
It's low frequency, and you also said it's low power too, right?
That's right, very low power. And they actually, how they send the signal, they modulate the power. Each bit, they actually raise the power, lower the power, so they communicate the bits through power fluctuation. Really, amplitude fluctuation is really AM signal, and they basically operate that way. But it's quite interesting. But daylight savings time this year, the reason it's such a big deal is this is the first year that daylight savings time has occurred March 11th. It usually was April 2nd. So now this year it's 3 weeks earlier because of a bill that Congress passed, the Energy Policy Act of 2005. Now, one problem that we get right off the bat, it's still wintertime. So how can we spring forward?
Well, we slide forward since it's winter, right?
Yeah, we have to winter forward. I don't know. It just doesn't work. They're going to have to come up with something else. So now we're in the middle of winter, and we had to go forward one hour. Now, the actual time change occurred last night at 1:59. So at 1:59, my atomic clock said 1:59. When it went to 3, when it went to 2 o'clock, it immediately was reset, and they all spun forward, and they reset at 2 o'clock. I have to admit, I got up last night.
That was pretty neat to watch,
yeah,
huh?
I got up I enjoyed that, and I reset all my cuckoo clocks after the thing was done.
I may have to buy one of these things just to watch it.
We will continue our discussion of clocks and daylight saving time when Tech Talk continues right after this on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. This is Dr. Richard Schertz with
Jim Russ, and thanks for wearing the corduroy blazer today since we're in the virtual faculty lounge.
That's right. We got all the couches ready to go. We've got the coffee bar set up, so we're really enjoying ourselves. You know, one little thing that people don't realize is not every state implemented daylight savings time. For instance, Arizona is not on daylight savings time.
Why?
I don't have a clue. I think they're just contrarian.
Half of the eastern half of Indiana in the same situation.
It's in the same boat too. But in the case of Arizona, you see the Navajo Indian Nation has decided to be on daylight savings time because their nation spans three states. So within Arizona, the Navajo Nation is on daylight savings time, but the rest of Arizona is not.
Well, that's nice and confusing.
I know it is. Hawaii is not on daylight savings time. That sort of makes sense. American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands. So it's not necessarily universally approved. I mean, China, for instance, is not on daylight savings time. Most countries don't do it. Did you know China, which spans five time zones, is only one time zone officially? They make everyone in China be on Beijing time.
Wow. That's amazing. But, you know, the name of this, first of all, it's daylight saving time, not savings.
That's right. There is no S after savings.
They threw that one away.
I know. That's actually kind of an interesting thing. I went and looked that up, and because it's daylight saving time, as in saving daylight kind of time, and it's or as in saving a ball game. It's not savings as in savings account. But most people just put the S on it, I have to say.
Yeah, we've kind of dropped it, too. We just say daylight time now.
Daylight time.
And we're not really saving anything, are we?
No, we're not.
Same amount of sunlight.
We're only shifting time. So it really should be daylight shifting time. But, you know, this is Congress at work, and they're trying to save energy. Now, it did create a small problem for computer people, mm-hmm. this daylight, because they want all the computers to reset automatically. And of course, the previous systems were set to, you know, implement daylight savings time on April 2nd. and not, they didn't account for this three-week shift. So everybody had to install a patch to actually implement the new daylight saving program. And Microsoft's patch came out 6 or 8 weeks ago, and it was automatically downloaded. A couple of weeks ago, Palm came out, and they said everybody had to change their Palm Pilot, and they had to update that in order to get the daylight savings time taken care of. I noticed that the BlackBerry Enterprise server, they require you to upgrade to the 4.0 edition before they give you the daylight savings patch.
Oh, how nice.
Which is about $1,000. I think that's even better. That's kind of a scam. I don't really like that at all. Now, what happens if you have a system that doesn't reset automatically? Like my phone system at work does not. I can't patch it with a new one. So if I go in today and change it to daylight savings time, then on April 2nd, it will go forward another hour. So then on April 2nd, I'll have to basically set it back an hour to bring it back into alignment, unless I can find a patch for this system.
So what are you going to do? Just leave it wrong for a couple of weeks? Or
no, I think we'll try to patch it. So all of the IT guys are going to have to come into work on April 2nd to try to fix things that weren't properly patched. Now, if you want to get the correct time on the Internet, have you ever noticed that? You'd like to find out what time you'd like to get. Now, how do you usually get your correct time?
Well, in the broadcasting business, I thought I was so smart and sharp by going and dialing the Naval Observatory.
Oh, I see.
Here in D.C.
That's a local number.
That's a local number.
And that's just that's a derivative time standard off of the official time standard put out by NIST. But you can actually.
But you can get it off the web, right?
You can get the official NIST time. You can go to a website called www.time.gov, and it will give you the official time display right on your computer screen. You just select what time zone you're in, and it gives it to you right off the bat. So you don't have to call anybody. You can just sit there and look at it, you know, blinking right along on your machine. Another interesting thing, you can also get your computers to automatically update the time. There's a website that NIST also has, time.nist.gov, and that puts out a network time protocol which communicates the time over the Internet to a computer. For instance, I can set my, if I want to just double check the time on my Windows machine, I can have it check the time against that NIST site. I can select it, it goes to the NIST site, and it resets the time automatically. So my actual, it used to be on your computer, like your battery would get weak, your clock would slow down. Now with this atomic time, the computers reset themselves to the atomic time standard over the Internet about every day. So even if your clock is slow, you don't notice it.
That's pretty neat. You want to talk briefly about how this atomic clock works?
Yeah, how much time do we have?
We've got a couple of minutes.
Okay, this is actually a cesium fountain atomic clock. Now, it's how this works, it's based on, you know, they had a... People have made cesium lasers. Cesium lasers, emit kind of a reddish radiation. And so they have a nice transition point or fluorescence point where it emits light. And so they're taking advantage of that. And what they do, they emit some cesium atoms into a vacuum. And they have six lasers focused on the cesium atoms. And these six lasers bunch up a little ball of cesium atoms in one place, and they cool them down to near absolute zero. Then they have two of the lasers force this ball of cesium atoms to drift through a microwave resonance cavity, which is actually, it's like a microwave oven. And they tune the frequency of this microwave cavity to make the cesium atoms emit light or fluoresce. And they keep tuning the frequency until they maximize the fluorescence. And that frequency that the microwave is set at is the resonant frequency of the cesium atom. And that's what's used for the time standard. And so this ball flows up through the resonant frequency, up through the cavity, and then it drops back again like a fountain. And then a little bit later, another ball goes up through the resonant cavity and back down again. And they keep tuning that resonant frequency each time a ball passes through, constantly resetting it. So it's actually a fairly simple idea, but they can achieve time accuracies of 1 second in 60 billion years, 60 million years. That amounts to a tenth of a nanosecond a day. A nanosecond is 10 to the minus 9 seconds, so it's 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 10 seconds per day accuracy.
Pretty simple concept, but the picture this shows it as a very large object. You wouldn't want to have one in your house,
no,
would you?
No, it's a fairly big object. Yeah,
the
yeah,
government does it so you don't have to,
that's
right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So now you know what the atomic clock is, and that's used to communicate with all of the radio frequency clocks out there.
This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
You've all heard of herbs and spices. Now, do you know what a spice is and you know what an herb is? That's the first thing.
No, not really.
Okay, well,
you know, there's a distinction.
There is a definite distinction. A spice is the ground up part of a plant. Like spices are usually dried flowers or the fruits of tropical trees. They actually, or in the case of ginger and turmeric, they are ground roots. Cinnamon is the inner bark of a tree. So you take a part of a plant, either the bark or the fruit or the seed, and you grind it up and you get a spice. On the other hand, herbs are the dried leaves of plants, usually annual plants or perennials. So herbs tend to be green, like a bay leaf.
Mm-hmm.
It's green. And so herbs can either be freshly picked or dried and stored in airtight containers. Drying tends to mellow the flavor, and this dried herb is preferred by some chefs because I think it mellows the flavor of the herb. Now, you've all heard of herbicide. An herbicide is you're basically going to take and kill the leafy weeds in the yard. So an herbicide kills herbs. You can see that. Now, when we smell an herb or a spice, we're actually smelling what they call the essential oils. Now, these essential oils are very volatile, and that's what makes the spices or the herbs fragrant. It's that same volatility, though, that causes them to lose flavor over time.
Okay.
So that's why you can't store them indefinitely. When you store a spice in a big chunk, it takes some time for the volatile oils to escape. So let's take a nutmeg, which would be a big, you know, it's a nut that's about a half inch in diameter. A nutmeg, if you don't grind it up, it will store the essential oils for a long time, and then you can just grind it as you need it. On the other hand, if you get ground nutmeg, it will give up its essential oils very quickly. And so many chefs actually prefer just to grind the spice at the time. Like, that's why you grind black pepper.
Right.
For instance, you got the peppercorn, you grind it just as you use it, you get much more pepper flavor.
And nutmeg's another one that people
nutmeg,
like.
Nutmeg, mm-hmm. Nutmeg would be another one. That's right. And so you want to keep them whole as long as possible.
But they go bad, don't they?
Even a whole spice could go bad eventually. Oh, you mean a whole spice because it's damp inside.
Right.
Because it could go rancid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a point. I don't know about that, but it's possible. That is possible. Now we're going to have a test. The test is going to be spice or herb. All right. Now let's go with cilantro and coriander.
Well, those are leaves, so I would say spice.
Now here's the deal. They both come from the same plant. They both come from the Coriandrum sativum.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, the leaves of that plant are an herb, cilantro. But the seeds of that same plant are ground up, and they form coriander.
I had no idea.
So the same plant produces both an herb and a spice.
That's amazing.
What do you think of that? All right. Nutmeg. Spice, herb.
Spice.
That's right. How about mace?
Herb? Did you say mace?
Mace. Yeah. Not that kind of mace.
No,
you spray.
It's an herb, right?
No, it's also a spice. Okay, Nutmeg, it turns out if you go to a nutmeg tree, the fruit of the nutmeg has sort of an outer fleshy part. You remove that, and you're left with the seed. The seed has a red lace coating on it. The red lace coating is mace.
Mm-hmm.
And you remove the red lace coating, which is the mace, and you're left with the brown nutmeg seed. So mace and nutmeg come from the same plant. Mace has also a nutmeg flavor, but it's a lighter in color, so if you need a nutmeg flavor in, say, a white sauce, you don't want to put brown specks of nutmeg, you use mace. It's not quite as strong as nutmeg, but it has the same nutmeg flavor. Okay, now this is a kind
of
an easy...
Would you put mace in your eggnog?
Yeah, you don't want to... Oh, you could do... No, you wouldn't want to do that. Okay, now this is a dead giveaway, but I've got to get... You guys got to get something. A bay leaf. Bay leaf. Herb or spice?
I'm going to say herb.
Herb. Okay, you're exactly right.
Can
bay
you
leaf.
Smoke a bay leaf?
Now, there's an interesting story. There's an interesting story about bay leaves. Bay leaves come from the sweet...
I like the way you think.
Bay or... You know, it is...
You got to raise the bar.
I am doing my base.
Sorry.
Bay leaves come from sweet bay or the laurel tree. Now, ancient Greeks and Romans crowned victors with wreaths of laurel. In other words, they had bay leaves on them. Bay leaves are a staple in American kitchen, used in soup, stews, meats. The term baccalaureate actually means laurel berry.
No kidding.
And it refers to the ancient practice of honoring scholars and poets with garland of the bay laurel. And that's where we get the baccalaureate degree, because they were putting bay leaves around their neck.
How about that?
The Romans felt that the leaves protected them against thunder and plague. The Italians and English thought bay leaves brought them good luck and warded off evil. I guess they didn't do much cooking with them, but they did have a very, very, very colorful background. Now let's take sweet basil. Is that an herb or a spice?
That would be an herb.
An herb, that's right. Basil is a bright green leafy plant. It's from the mint family. Basil's widely used in Italian cuisine, often paired with tomatoes. Basil originated in Indian Persia and was prized and despised by ancient people. Although its name means bee fragrant, Greeks hated it. However, the Romans loved it and made it a symbol of love and fertility.
No idea.
Hindus planted in their homes to bring happiness to the family. And now the last one is very interesting, but I want to go saffron. Herb or spice?
Wow. I'm going to say that's...
Spice.
Spice.
Definitely.
You are right. It is spice. Saffron comes from the stigma of the crocus, which is a crocus flower. Now, you see, this is part of the flower, and flowers have both male parts and female parts. The stamen is the male part, the female part is the pistil, and the stigma is part of the pistil.
Yes. Now, I'm trying, Doctor. I really am. Naveed's trying to lead me down the path, and
now,
I'm not going.
Listen, saffron is the world's most expensive spice.
Yeah, it is.
Listen... Now, you see, it costs 225,000 stigmas have to be taken from a crocuses to make 1 pound of saffron.
That explains it.
I mean, you're picking a lot of stigmas on that one. Saffron is used in French bouillabaisse, Spanish paella, risotto, and many other Eastern dishes.
Good in rice?
Ancient Greeks scattered saffron to perfume public baths. 13th century crusaders brought saffron from Asia to Europe, where it was used as a dye and condiment. Now, this is an interesting thing. There's also a fake saffron.
Mm-hmm.
Turmeric, which is also known as Indian saffron, is a substitute for saffron. It's yellow it looks the same as saffron when it's dry, but as soon as you make it, as soon as you add water, it's a different color than saffron. Turmeric is used to stretch saffron by unscrupulous retailers.
How about that?
And that's important because you might pay $500 a pound for saffron.
No doubt.
So there's a lot of unscrupulous dealers out there with saffron. So there's all you wanted to know about herbs and spices.
That's fascinating stuff. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you next week for more of Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual